All right, we are back a little bit early because I know you, all you folks, will get over it. So we are here with Ronald Kessler. He's a former investigative reporter with experience at the Boston Herald, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post, who subsequently retired to write books, including 21 titles to his credit, including some New York Times bestsellers, and including the FBI inside the world's most powerful law enforcement agency, and The Season inside the secret society, the upper crust of Palm Beach, and most recently, the Trump White House, changing the rules of the game. So, welcome, Ron, to the show.
Very good to be with you. Thank you.
All right. So, I have a bunch of different topics I want to go over here, and I know I've got some people in the audience who are especially excited to hear about Trump, especially considering, you know, how things have changed since you first wrote the book. But it's my show, so we're going to talk about investigative reporting in general first. So from this, I found this actually on your Wikipedia page. But so Kessler's book, The FBI, Inside the World's Most Powerful Law Enforcement Agency, led to the dismissal by President Clinton of William S. Sessions as FBI director over his abuses. According to the Washington Post, a Justice Department official noted that the original charges against Sessions came not from FBI agents, but from a journalist, Ronald Kessler. Now, the New York Times said that your FBI book, quote, did indeed trigger Bureau and Justice Department investigations into alleged travel and expense abuses by FBI Director William Sessions. So my question to you on this subject is, nowadays it's common in at least some circles to hear people talk about how, like, notoriously insular even local police departments are. And I have to imagine there's some kind of similar culture at the FBI. So how did you, as an investigative journalist, break past that sort of thing? Where do you get an in with an organization like the FBI?
Well, I think, first of all, people appreciate that I'm sincerely interested in how they do their jobs. In the case of the FBI, I was interested in how they did criminal profiling. I did the first story on that in 1985 in the Washington Post. I went out to the firearms training. I went into that shoot, don't shoot exercise. And I think, you know, that gives me an in to begin with. In addition, I have a track record, I think, of telling the truth. Of reporting honestly on both sides. And in the course of doing that with that FBI book, I got total cooperation ordered by Sessions himself. I was able to interview agents in field offices without going through PR people. And lo and behold, one individual whispered that there's a lot more going on here involving Sessions abuses. And that ranged from installing a fence that had no security value on his home to trips back to San Francisco to see his daughter on the FBI plane, and on and on and on. A lot of it was propelled by his wife, Alice, who insisted on having access to the FBI building, even though she didn't have a security clearance to allow her in without showing any identification. And eventually it turned out that the Justice Department began an investigation based on what I reported, and that, as you say, led to his dismissal.
So would you say that Sessions learned to kind of rue the day that he let you talk to his agents?
No question. But, you know, he didn't seem to have a lot of sense. You know, on the one hand, he had a very good reputation as a federal judge. He seemed to know the law. He seemed to be a rational person. And yet, you know, who would do this? And even when I started exposing some of this, he still continued to take these trips, for example, to the ballet in Baltimore on the FBI plane. Just knew no remorse, apparently had no conscience. And it's a sad ending to a guy who had a pretty good career.
All right. Now, you've talked about a couple of things here that, frankly, almost sound anachronistic in today's world. Things like honestly reporting both sides, focused entirely on the truth, consistent record, those sorts of things. I feel like in the world that I've kind of grown up in politically, that those things are really not valued so highly as they once were. And in fact, in the Trump book, or go ahead.
Well, in fact, you know, over and over again, you see that they're not only not valued, but approved by editors. Just incredible to me, as to you, that you see, you know, dishonesty in story after story, stories that have a lead that's sensational, and then at the end they put in a sentence that totally undercuts the lead and shows that the whole story was phony. I call them scam artists, these people who claim to be journalists, but are just like scam artists. They thrive on really, really fiction, and you just see it everywhere. I, as you say, was at the Washington Post. I was there for 15 years as an investigative reporter. I sat next to Carl Bernstein during Watergate, and Woodward would come over to his desk, and they would write the story for the next day's paper together. It was said that Woodward had English as a second language. He was a very bad writer. I think he's improved since then. So, and they would argue back and forth and discuss their sources. And there was tremendous pressure on them and on me as an investigative reporter to tell the truth and to put in the countervailing information if there was such. That has totally changed.
So what is, when you talk about it, this has changed. So if I was to go and sit in the bullpen at the Washington Post today, instead of seeing Woodward and Bernstein there trying to overcome Woodward's difficulties with the English language so that they could more effectively tell the truth, what's the priority today?
Well, the priority first is to get views on the internet, and so reporters are rewarded, promoted based on views. And of course, if you can come up with some totally dishonest claim, you get more views. That's the first priority. I think you get a sense of what's going on when, for example, you hear on some of the networks these snarky comments. It's just, you know, fashionable to make fun of everything and to disclaim or, you know, discount whatever anybody in some official position says. And if the White House issues a statement, whether it's the Biden White House or the Trump White House, mainly Trump White House, of course, it's simply discounted. But, you know, I even see that sometimes with the Biden White House. You know, the White House asserted this and that, and there's some information that totally undercuts the point. For example, a story appeared in January about the Kushners and their Secret Service protection, saying that the Secret Service rented toilets from a neighbor, a bathroom from a neighbor, at $3,000 a month. And the story said that the agents were instructed not to use the Kushners' bathrooms. And, you know, the impression was that the agents just wanted to use them occasionally. In fact, because the Secret Service protected them 24 hours a day, they would have been traipsing through the house all day, all night long if they had been using their toilets. But more to the point, this is simply routine. And it turns out that it was the Secret Service that said we have to rent toilets at a neighbor's house. It was not the Kushners, but yet the story said the agents were instructed not to use the toilets. Just very, very sleazy, very cunning manipulation, sometimes just by omission, to convey a false story.
All right. Well, Dan Stewart here in the live comments has kind of preempted my next question. He says, has Mr. Kessler heard of the trend toward advocacy journalism instead of objective journalism? So I guess this would be a journalism not to get views, but to win battles for a particular political side.
Yeah, well, that's something that is not part of journalism. And, you know, if you can be an activist, you can write all the stories you want, make up stories if you want. That's advocacy. There's so much, you know, misappropriation of terminology these days as well. And that's one example to equate advocacy with journalism.
So when you hear people say, for example, well, you know, the New York Times today is basically just the public relations arm of the Democratic Party, do you feel like that's accurate? Do you feel like that's an unfair characterization?
I think it is unfair because it ignores the fact that periodically they do stories on the other side and do stories that are worthwhile. For example, exposing the lawyer or the producer in Hollywood and and that led to the Me Too movement. And you know, okay, they had a story a few weeks ago saying that actually if we go to electric cars, in most cases, the emissions from the power plants to drive the cars will actually exceed, in most cases, exceed the emissions from normal generators. So you do see that occasionally. You see that in the Washington Post occasionally, which said recently in a news story that border intrusions are up higher than ever going back 20 years. But most of the time, it's the other direction. It's totally unfair, dishonest reporting, and it is disgusting.
But it sounds like you're saying it's mostly motivated by a desire to get views or attract eyes, not to fight for a particular political side. Is that accurate? Is that what you're saying?
No, I shouldn't have put it like that. No, it's a combination. I mean,
okay.
Number one is the views, and number two certainly is the fact that 90% of journalists on newspapers identify as Democrats. That doesn't mean that they can't do an honest job, but that's a clue as to what their motivations are. But it's groupthink. It's a herd instinct. I've always been very independent minded. I left college after 2 years. I couldn't stand to be told what to read, how to think by professors. I wanted to do my own cultivation of sources and get my own information firsthand if possible. And that's the way I am. And I, in the course of doing investigative reporting, of course, do produce things that are worthwhile to society. For example, I exposed the fact in the 80s that the Daughters of the American Revolution had refused to admit a black woman to membership, even though she had the correct lineage, because she was black. And I interviewed the president of the DAR, and she actually said, you know, sometimes people don't want to have you at a party, so what? We don't have to invite you. And after that, she left, and the DAR changed its policies, put her in charge of the scholarship committee, made her a member, created programs to recruit blacks. That's just one example. Now, someone can call that advocacy journalism. No, it's not. It's simply truthful journalism, and that's what I'd like to do.
Gotcha. Well, the other element to that is, at least this is something that I've heard rumor of, is the idea that investigative journalism itself is just not lucrative enough to maintain like a place of pride in the arsenals of places like the Washington Post or the Wall Street Journal or the New York Times. The mainstream outlets are not paying for investigative journalists to spend 6 months putting together a story where once upon a time they might have. Is that, I mean, what's your experience?
No, no, that's not true. I've never had a problem with being given the time to do an investigative story. And today, you know, papers that are financially stable, like the Washington Post and the New York Times, do devote, you know, up to a year to investigative projects. That's not an issue. A lot of times it's a question of what they choose to look at. But, you know, some very good work is still being done.
Okay. Well, as long as we're talking about that, that actually brings me kind of into your most recent book, which is The Trump White House, Changing the Rules of the Game. And I have to say, I went into the book expecting something very different from what I found. I actually, when I saw the cover and I was looking at it, and I was like, okay, so this is probably going to be like Bob Woodward's books about the Trump White House. And then I opened it up and started reading, and I was like, wow, this is not at all what I was expecting. And one of the things you write in the book, you say, quote, from minor to major stories, by my estimate, roughly half of the exclusives reported by the media about Trump have turned out to be wrong. And of course, we had one of these in the media recently where it turned out that the very often repeated story about Trump, quote, tear gassing protesters so that he could take a photo op holding a Bible was not correct. And a lot of people have lost faith in mainstream media outlets. Like, surveys indicate all-time lows of confidence in mainstream media. Some people would say because of the way they covered Trump. So what was it about Trump, in your experience, that made the media want to go after him so much to the point that they were willing to write these, like, completely incorrect stories?
I think it was mainly an extension of the fact that most journalists are liberal and they seek approval from their peers, and they sort of boast to each other how they got Trump this time and that time, which is not to say that, you know, Trump didn't bring some of this on himself with his false statements, but at the same time, the media have ignored the tremendous successes, you know, whether it's lowest unemployment in history, lowest black unemployment in history, tremendous records in the stock market, stopping the border intrusions almost entirely. So that is something that, you know, was a phenomenon involving Trump. I saw it under George W. Bush as well. The media just hate Republicans, and they'll look for anything or make up a story to try to put down any Republican.
Gotcha. And Dan Stewart is back again with another question. He says, Mr. Kessler has written books about the FBI and has previously interviewed Special Counsel Mueller when he was FBI director. So how do you feel about the Mueller report and the Mueller investigation? Was that more of this, we want to take down Trump? Or, well, what were your thoughts?
I was disappointed in what Mueller did. On the one hand, the report overall was factual and very detailed. But then when he said, we are not exonerating Trump, that was just ridiculous. You know, you can't, there's no such thing in prosecutions as he's not exonerated. And that was, I think it was one of his underlings who must have insisted on that, because as I said in my FBI books, Mueller did a tremendous job as FBI director. There was never any hint of impropriety or abuse. In fact, he turned around the FBI to make it much more prevention oriented after 9/11. And I go into that in my latest book on the FBI, The Secrets of the FBI, how the FBI, instead of looking at one case, such as the first World Trade Center bombing case, and then going on to some other case, would in fact continue to develop sources in that realm. And that's why we have not had a successful attack by a foreign terrorist organization since 9/11. But the report, you know, was a disappointment to me.
Okay, fair enough. So you don't think it was politically motivated, though, the whole Mueller investigation?
Well, yeah, I do, and I go into, I've gone into that, and it's quite clear how that started, namely Peter Strzok, an FBI agent, started the investigation based on really nothing. A Trump low-level aide, Papadopoulos, told the Australian ambassador, Downer, that there was some suggestion that Russia wanted to give negative information about Hillary to the Trump campaign, but he didn't know, you know, what happened or whether the Trump organization actually accepted it. And in fact, in my Trump book, I quoted emails showing that Papadopoulos tried to get the campaign to go to Russia and make nice with Putin, and they all rejected it. Manafort emailed the chairman of the campaign, emailed, we're not going to do this. We don't want to have anything to do with it. He appointed a deputy to make sure nobody follows up on this and to tell Trump, we can't do this. You know, what more do you need to know about whether Trump was in bed with the Russians? And yet all that was ignored. In addition to that, the whole idea of having a special counsel was recommended by Andrew McCabe, who was the acting FBI director after Trump fired Comey. And McCabe explained in his book why he started another investigation, a counterintelligence investigation, specifically targeting Trump. And in the book, he said, well, Trump gave this interview to Lester Holt of NBC, and he said, when I fired Comey, I thought about this Russia thing. But then Trump went on to say, but I knew that if I fired Comey, it would just prolong the FBI investigation. And in other words, he's going to continue the investigation. But guess what? That countervailing information did not appear in Andrew McCabe's book. He dishonestly did not include that because it would have undercut. And yet he started the investigation and recommended the special counsel appointment based on this. And then he threw in, oh, and also Trump keeps criticizing the FBI and belittling the FBI. That's a reason to start a criminal investigation. It's just shocking. And again, you know, you don't see this in the media. It's in my book, but it's in Andrew McCabe's book, and it tells you just how dishonest and corrupt that decision was.
That actually goes to the next thing I wanted to bring up, because the book is, or the Trump White House book, is very sympathetic to Trump, at least on a first reading. It seems like, if I had to guess, if I didn't have you in front of me and I couldn't ask you myself, I would go through the rest of my life assuming that you were a pretty big fan of Donald Trump, at least from the tone, overall tone of the book, even though you do point out a lot of mistakes that he made, a lot of things that he, as you kind of phrase it, did wrong. But what I wanted to ask you is, so when you talk in the book, when you say things like, if I remember correctly, Melania is as stunning as she is poised, and she has an independent mind, and then Trump is a businessman, he's always working, he's very dedicated to what he does, he was already worth $1.5 billion by the time his father died. Are these your unvarnished opinions of the Trumps, or are you trying to maybe counteract the Bob Woodwards of the world?
I wasn't trying to counteract anything, I was just trying to tell the truth as I know it. And she is stunning, and I have seen her many times, and I have a picture of me with my arm around her at one of the Mar-a-Lago functions, and she's just even more beautiful than she appears in person. And that's the long and the short of it. But at the same time, as you say, I have dozens of critical elements as well in the book. For example, Trump raged against Sessions because he would not, because he recused himself as Attorney General from the whole FBI investigation. And I explained in the book that he had to. Sessions was required, in fact, by law to recuse himself. And I quoted the law and I quoted the regulations. And Trump would say, well, he should, if he knew that, he should have, he never should have accepted the position of Attorney General. Well, he didn't know a damn thing because before he was Attorney General, he didn't know what the FBI was doing, had no idea that they were doing anything with Trump. And so he couldn't have declined the appointment. So it's quite simple, in my opinion, that the book simply tells the truth. And if some of that positive information seems like a spin job, that I think that's just because you're not used to reading anything positive about Trump. But this is simply factual information, and very different from what you see in the media.
So on that note, I wanted to share a little story with my viewers that's in the book. And I might pronounce this guy's name wrong, but Tony Senecal, Trump's personal butler. Am I saying that right?
Tony Senecal.
Tony Senecal. So I guess Martha Stewart had shown up at Mar-a-Lago, and Tony Senecal had scheduled a tour. She wanted to tour the place, and he scheduled the tour for the next day at 3 p.m. And I guess Trump wasn't such a huge fan of that idea. And as you tell it in the book, Trump is, for lack of a better phrase, reaming out Senecal about not scheduling Martha Stewart at lunchtime. And I guess Melania steps in and says, you know, you really shouldn't be talking to Tony like that. And to quote you, Trump never said another word about it. But the next morning, when he and Senecal were in the mansion's living room, Trump, without explanation, handed him $2,000 in 20s. It was his way of apologizing, Senecal said. So, I mean, is this characteristic of the Trump that we never see? Is this the real Trump here?
Yeah, that's exactly the point. These are the behind-the-scenes vignettes that tell you more about Trump. And on the one hand, he just became livid at Tony Senecal just because Tony scheduled this tour by Martha Stewart at 3 the next day instead of at noon, when the club members would see Martha and Martha would see them and they'd be impressed, because, of course, Trump is always promoting Mar-a-Lago. That's the negative side. But then you see that Melania has an influence on Trump. She's always portrayed in the media as just some rag doll who goes along with everything. And yet she stepped in and said, I don't think you should be talking to Tony in that tone. But then the next morning, Trump apologizes by giving Tony $2,000 in cash. So it's let's say, two sides of Donald Trump, the positive and the negative.
All right. So that hits on something else that I wanted to bring up here, and it's from another quote in the book. You write, Trump will phone Maggie Haberman of The New York Times directly, as well as Philip Rucker of The Washington Post and Jonathan Swan of Axios, feeding them stories attributed to, quote, a senior White House official, creating the impression the White House leaks even more than it already does. In other words, Trump is a leaker from his own administration, or I guess he was a leaker in his own administration. So what is he, why would he do something like that? That seems very counterintuitive to me.
Actually, it's brilliant, because he understands that if a story is attributed to a source, it will get more play. If it quotes someone, you know, people become skeptical of the person or the person's motives. If it's attributed to a source, they believe it's real. And so he understands that. I mean, he's a very, very smart and sly guy. He didn't amass $2 billion for nothing. And he didn't become president for nothing. He has a lot of positive attributes, and that's if you want to call it that, even though it may be dishonest, That's one way that he operates.
All right. Now, I'm sure you've seen the news that Trump was quoted as saying that he'll be reinstated as president in August. So as somebody who's interviewed him a bunch of times, who apparently knows him, at least on some level, can you hazard a guess what he's up to in saying that? Does he really think he'll be president in August?
No, I think he is a rational person. I don't think he's crazy, as many would believe or assume, given that he said that. But it's all part of his shtick. And he thinks that by continuing this election with stolen routine, that he will have enough followers to become president, maybe. I don't think that's true. I think he certainly stirs up his base, but the base is diminishing, and that's not enough to become to win a presidency.
Now, you say the base is diminishing. Where are they going? Are they converting to, are they becoming Democratic Socialists? Are they dying off? What's happening to them?
Certainly a lot of them were turned off by what happened on January 6th. So that immediately diminished the support. At the CPAC meeting, the conservative meeting in Florida, where you have nothing but activists and influencers, only half in a straw poll said that he should run again. And that really tells you a lot, I think. I think it tells you more than some of the polls where people don't necessarily tell the truth. Where are they going? You know, I found that any prediction early on in political races usually turns out to be wrong. We certainly saw that with the first Trump campaign and all the various people who were in the primary, like Jeb Bush, who disappeared very quickly, and not to mention Kamala Harris. I think there's no point in trying to speculate now on who might become president.
Gotcha. Okay. So, and Dan Stewart asked another question. Does Mr. Kessler feel that Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner were a net negative for the Trump presidency? And this actually fits into what we were just talking about, because I know that, for example, Ann Coulter, who was like the biggest fan of Trump ever early on, really kind of split with him and was not such a fan later on. And she really blamed Jared and Ivanka for turning Trump in a different direction than his initial kind of nationalistic, economic populist kind of direction. So what are your thoughts on those two?
Yeah, I do say in the book that Ivanka and Jared recommended firing Comey, which was a very bad decision, even though Comey certainly is not perfect, but it led to the special counsel investigation. They also recommended hiring Scaramucci, which was a disastrous hire to be PR director. He lasted 11 days. But at the same time, they contributed a lot of positive elements, such as the whole Benjamin Accords that Jared worked on. Some of the jail reform issues that Jared worked on. But, you know, to say that A or B or C was responsible for Trump going one direction or another is very naive. You know, Trump is a very independent thinker. He will listen to a wide variety of people, not only his aides, but he'll just ask some chambermaid or some Secret Service agent, what do you think of this? What do you think of that? And in the end, he makes up his mind. And I think it's always a mistake to think that one aide is so powerful that he or she propelled the president in one direction or another.
Mm-hmm. Even though they have the big family connection.
Yeah, I mean, do you listen to your family on who you should have on your show?
That's a very good point. So you write in the book that Trump actually told Jared and Ivanka to go back to New York, but apparently he didn't press the issue very much. So what happened there? Why didn't he just fire them?
Well, he's not very good at firing people. You know, he will have someone else do it sometimes, as happened with Comey. But he seems to be timid when it comes to actually severing ties, and certainly when it comes to a family member, that would have been very difficult, understandably. But they overall, I think they were a positive contribution, and he did value what they did. Jared was very important in the campaign. He really ran the campaign, as opposed to some other people who claim to run the campaign. They were important elements of his administration.
Now, when you say people who claim to run the campaign, I'm guessing you're talking about Kellyanne Conway. Is that correct?
Right. Kellyanne had the title of campaign director, but she really did very little. Which is not to say that she is very smart and savvy and helped Trump formulate positions, but she was not, in fact, the director of the campaign in terms of actually directing what happened.
Now, this is a bit of a side thing, but it just occurred to me, and I want to get your take on it if you would be so kind. But did you at all follow the kind of bizarre drama between Kellyanne Conway and her daughter that played out, like, on social media? Kellyanne Conway's daughter talking about bizarre things going on in the household, and you can actually hear her mother in the background yelling at her. Did you hear about any of this?
Oh, yeah. It was just unfortunate. I think, you know, we all know that teenagers can get out of hand for one reason or another, and apparently she has, daughter has calmed down now. It's really unfortunate because I know that Kellyanne is very devoted to her kids. When I interviewed her one time, one of her younger kids called her, and she took the call right away on her cell phone and said, "I love you." You could tell that she's a very tender-hearted mother.
All right. So while you make no bones about kind of highlighting the good stuff that Trump has done, as well as the mistakes that he's made, there's a couple places in the book where there seems to be this kind of counterpoint that juxtaposes the Trump administration, specifically against the Obama administration, against the Bush administration. And I don't think there's a ton of comparisons that work out so well for the Obamas. For example, a quote, "Secret Service agents were dismayed to overhear Michelle Obama push her husband to be more aggressive in attacking Republicans and to side with blacks in police shooting controversies. Having listened to their talk in the presidential limousine, a former Secret Service agent says, quote, Michelle's agenda goes back to when she said about her husband running for president, for the first time in my adult lifetime, I'm really proud of my country. So my question to you is, what motivated you to include these sorts of details in the book?
Well, the book that we're talking about, The First Family Detail, is about the Secret Service. And part of that is what the Secret Service observes when they're guarding the various protectees. So that is what I was doing. I was reporting what the Secret Service encounters when protecting, you know, whether it's Carter or Trump or Obama. And again, it's an honest attempt. In that case, I also said that Obama himself treats his agents with consideration and respect, and that both he and Michelle invite them to partake of parties and food. And so it's simply an honest account of how each of the protectees interacts with their agents.
Okay, fair enough. So there was one kind of explosive, at least to me, revelation in the book. I had no idea this went on. But you write about the history of Mar-a-Lago and Trump's association with it. And there's some rather explosive tidbits about the local Palm Beach society. And I know you wrote a whole book on this, but trying to bar Trump from turning Mar-a-Lago into a club that would, as you write, quote, admit Jews and blacks. You also write that as of 2018, there are to this day clubs in Palm Beach that will not admit minorities. So there's a couple of things there, but I see you're about to answer, so go ahead.
You know, people would understandably wonder why I would do a book on Palm Beach, given my other subjects, which are serious looks at the CIA, the Secret Service, the FBI. As you say, one of the books lists the dismissal of Sessions as director. Another book exposed the fact that the Secret Service agents in Cartagena guarding Obama had gone to see prostitutes and had to be sent home. That's the story they broke. But Palm Beach, besides being a place where I could drink more champagne and go to more parties, is in its own way a very secretive society with its own rituals and customs, and it was a challenge to penetrate, to find out just what goes on there. In the case of Mar-a-Lago, the city, the town fathers did not want to approve Mar-a-Lago as a club. Everything is very highly controlled in Palm Beach. Trump had bought Mar-a-Lago originally built by Marjorie Meriwether Post, the Post serial heiress. It was pretty clear, especially through his lawyer, who's Jewish and was plugged into everything in Palm Beach, that many of the members of the town council did not want to approve the club because Trump planned to admit blacks and Jews. In fact, a few of the town council members were members of one or two of those clubs that still to this day will not admit blacks or Jews, believe it or not. That's the way the whole thing started. Of course, you're not going to see that in the mainstream media because that would just make Trump look good. We can't say that Trump actually is not a racist. No, we can't. So that part of his history is always ignored.
Mm-hmm. Well, you touched on the things I was going to ask about. First of all, my absolute incredulity that there are still places in Palm Beach or frankly anywhere else in the United States that have specific policies against admitting African Americans or Jewish people. But on the other hand, there is this thing about, well, so you're really saying that in the Palm Beach society, Trump was the one who wasn't racist when for years, if I listened to just the mainstream media, I would come away with the impression that Trump is deeply racist, specifically against Hispanic people, and that he's not such a huge fan of black people or even Jews either. So what are we to make of all these other stories in the media about, for example, him and his father, I guess, refusing to rent to black people in New York, or stories of kicking all the black car dealers off the floor at his casinos in preparation for certain honored guests coming to the casino? Is this more of just the media writing fake stories, or is there something else at work here? What's your take?
Some of it is people who have worked for him or know him and make up stories. For example, Barbara Rez, who was in charge of building his Trump Tower in New York, whom I interviewed, told me Trump put her in charge of that building. And back then, a female construction executive was unheard of. And he said, consider it your own money, do what you think is right. That's what she said. But now she appears on CNN to say some of the things you were saying, that he was racist, et cetera. Well, guess what? Trump, for almost 2 years, dated Kara Young, a black model before he met Melania. So I don't know what kind of racist that you can be if you date a black model. Now, on the other hand, Trump certainly does step up to the line. He likes to create controversy. And so in the case of the Charlotte episode, he said there were fine people on both sides. What he was referring to was the people on the one people who were against tearing down the Confederate statue simply because they were against, you know, tearing down our history. They were not neo-Nazis. They were perfectly fine people, as he said. But at the same time, you know, and of course the media conflated all that so to make it look like he was talking about neo-Nazis. But at the same time, Trump knows when he makes some of these inflammatory comments that they probably will be misinterpreted and misconstrued, either purposely or not purposely. So it's a combination of issues. But if you look at, you know, his policies, the fact that under Trump, we had the lowest black unemployment rate, the lowest black Hispanic, lowest female unemployment rate in history, I think that tells you a lot.
All right. So how have so you obviously you've interviewed Trump a number of times. It sounds like you have a pretty close relationship with him, at least as close as a journalist and a subject can really get before it starts to become like some other relationship, a friendship or something. But how have events since the publication of your book changed your take on Trump as a person, as a politician, and maybe changed your opinion of his future in politics? Can you update, like, give me a quick update on the book with all the stuff that happened between 2018 and today in 2021?
Well, I think everyone is aware of what happened on January 6th and what led up to it and what happened during the what I would call insurrection, and the fact that Trump was watching it on TV, the fact that he continues to say that the election was stolen. I'm sure everyone has made up their mind about this, and I don't know if there's any need to go into it all because, you know, it's all pretty clear. And as you can tell, I'm not a fan of what happened on January 6th.
I think, honestly, a lot of people who were fans of Trump, really, they stopped being fans. And that period of a couple of hours when that protest turned into a riot, insurrection, whatever you want to call it, depending on which side of the aisle you're on, a lot of people just kind of walked away from Trump at that point. So do you think he's politically dead? Is he gone forever from the world of electoral politics? Or can he make a comeback?
No, I don't think he can make a comeback. As I said about the CPAC straw poll, that tells me a lot, but only half said he should run again. You know, he's going to keep exerting influence on people who run for office in the GOP. But I think over time that's going to wane. He just made the wrong move.
Now, you talk in the book about Trump as an agent of change, and I'm paraphrasing here, but it's something like Trump had a bigger impact or a more lasting impact on American politics in a shorter time than almost any other president ever. So my question is, having seen now how the Trump presidency ended up, do you think it's likely that any of the changes that Trump made will have any lasting impact? Or are people going to kind of paper over the Trump presidency and kind of pretend that we went straight from Obama to Biden and try to undo everything that he did? Is he going to have a lasting impact?
Well, certainly Biden is undoing a large number of actual actions that Trump took. But on the other hand, I think that some of his ideas and approaches will be lasting because people think they were smart. I just wonder how long this border issue is going to continue. It's obviously an embarrassment to the country, and The fact is that Hillary and other key Democrats, including Obama, voted for building a wall when they were in Congress, but now all of a sudden, of course, they're all against it. And the whole idea of overregulation, I think, is something that people are going to keep in mind, and the fact that it stifles expansion and discourages hiring of new employees. So I don't think everything is going to be forgotten. I think another GOP candidate could come in and embrace many of those policies, but not with Trump's personality.
Fair enough. So you think he popularized that kind of nationalism, economic nationalism, the anti-immigrant stance? Is that such a force to be reckoned with now? It's here to stay in the Republican Party, right?
Say it again, I'm sorry.
Oh, Trump's unique kind of brand of Republicanism. The right. Stuff that he, like the he ran on a very similar platform to what Patrick Buchanan ran on back in the 90s, but Trump was just more successful with it. So is that a force that's going to stick around in politics in general, in your personal opinion?
Yeah, I think it will. You know, it's sort of an extension of the Tea Party, which came before Trump. So there is this element within the GOP of populist sentiment. And I think that that's going to remain with us forever.
All right. And so what would you say will be Trump's legacy ultimately? Like when we look back from far in the future, how will history remember him?
Well, I think unfortunately he will be remembered by what happened on January 6th. You know, in the case of Richard Nixon, he's remembered for Watergate, which was a criminal enterprise that he was involved in. I think the same with Trump, not to mention the fact that the media and historians will lean liberal and will not want to give him credit for anything anyway. So he's not going to have a very, very sterling appearance in the history books.
So looking back, I like that comparison. Looking back in 30 years and defending Trump will be like trying to defend Richard Nixon today. Saying, hey, no, don't pay attention to Watergate. Pay attention to all the stuff that happened before that is like saying, don't pay attention to January 6th. Pay attention to all the stuff that happened before that.
Yeah, and, you know, I think that's fair. I mean, you can always go into more detail about what a president did, but you know, people have a right to come up with an appraisal that focuses on what they think is the most important thing. And I think people will focus on January 6th.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, it's evident from your book that your relationship with the former president you have a good relationship with him, it sounds like. You mentioned that you have an honorary membership at Mar-a-Lago. You talk about warning the president about threats to his safety if he got out of the presidential limousine. And then you write, quote, in the days leading up to his New Year's Eve party celebrating 2017, when I chatted with Trump at Mar-a-Lago about problems in the Secret Service and other matters, Trump asked my opinion on Israeli settlements and the two-state solution. I know as much about the Middle East as Trump knows about the Talmud, but I gave my opinion. So I wanted to ask you, like, how close is your relationship with the former president? Do you guys hang out?
No, he doesn't hang out in the sense of, you know, going to have drinks at the local bar. You know, it's all at Mar-a-Lago or at the White House. And, I pretty much cited what my contacts have been with him and with Melania over the past, over two decades. That's all fine. It's all truthful and I explain in the book why I thought highly of him, but I also had the negatives in there. In 2011, I wrote an article saying don't underestimate Trump for president. So I had a pretty prescient view of where he was going. And I don't regret anything that I heard about him, because I think it was an honest appraisal up until the point when the book came out.
All right, fair enough. Well, that brings us to the end of our hour together. So thank you very much, Ron Kessler, for coming on Socratic Citizen. I think this has been a fantastic interview, and I hope our viewers drew as much from it as I did. So hopefully we can have you back on the next time you put out some book breaking down something that we all have some really shallow understanding of and give us a little bit more depth on it.
Well, I really
so do you want to... Do you have anything you want to promote? Do you have any books coming out? Anything like that?
No, but my website is ronaldkessler.com. So everything is on that website.
All right, ronaldkessler.com. Thank you, Ron, for coming on the show.
Thank you.
All right, folks, that brings us to the end of Episode 5, The Consent of the Governed. So we will be back next week. We'll be interviewing Manuel Galván, who will be coming to talk to us about economic inequality and his studies in sociology. So that brings us to the end of this. I am Patrick Cunningham, and this has been another episode of Socratic Citizen.